So this is an interview with Bernardine Evaristo.
Professor Bernardine Evaristo, MBA.
David Bernard, can see he's in charge here. Right, so we're interviewing you about theatre of black women.
Yeah.
And I guess we'll kind of start really, really simple, because obviously this is about theatre of black women, but it's also about GLC. Mm. And how the two kind of intertwined, and also about the broader politics of the day. So if you could just start off with, like, how would you describe your background?
My personal background. Well, I was raised in Woolwich, southeast London. I was educated in Eltham. I went to a girls' grammar school. I come from a sort of, I suppose, immigrant working class family. My father was Nigerian, and my mother was white English. They married in the 50s, had 8 children in 10 years, which was a lot, had very little money. And that's it in a nutshell. I was born in 1975. And it's a lie. I was born in
1959. How would you describe London when you were growing up and coming of age?
You know, when I was growing up, you don't know London usually when you're young, unless you've got the advantage of being able to travel around the city. So all you know is the area you grow up in and where you go to school. So I knew Woolwich, Plumstead, was where I lived. I knew Eltham a little bit, where I went to school. I knew Blackheath a little bit because my best friend lived there from the age of 12, so I went there a lot. I knew Greenwich a little bit. I knew the centre of London, which is where I kind of, from the age of 16, I had Saturday jobs. So that's the London that I knew. But the London that I really knew was the sort of southeast area of London that I grew up in. My parents settled in Woolwich, which was a bit more mixed than other parts of the capital. So they actually, initially I was born in Eltham and they wanted to raise kids there, but they realised it wasn't the right environment because it was very white. So then they moved to Woolwich, which was a bit more mixed, but it wasn't really mixed at all. You know, I mean, not by today's standards, because today you'd call Woolwich Little Lagos. It's so African. When I was growing up, my father was pretty much the only African in the village. You know, but in my road, there was my family, there was a Indian family from Goa. There might have been other people of colour, I don't remember. I don't think there were. My first school was a convent school, which was literally the house next door to where I grew up. And it was actually a private school. It didn't really feel like a private school. But it was, I think it was £10 a year to go there. So it was a Catholic private school. But when I say that, it then makes me sound middle class, but we weren't, we were poor. And then my mother was a school teacher. So she then went back to work when the youngest was of age to go to school. So then I transferred to a school up the hill, which is where she was teaching. And there was, from my memory, there was one black woman in my year, black girl, called Yasmin Yusuf, whose career I sort of picked up about 10 years ago, and she was like the sort of creative designer for Marks and Spencers for many years, and then she went to somewhere like Next. And I remember when I first saw her in a magazine, I was like, oh my God, that's Yasmin Yusuf. But she and I didn't really talk or anything, but we were on the same netball team. And there was a black boy, I think, in the school, and I think that was it. So it was a very white, working class, possibly lower middle class. Certain areas might be a bit more lower middle class. You know how class obsessed we are in the UK, part of London. Then I went to this grammar school, which was, I was the only black girl there for most of my time there until when I was in the sixth form, it became a comprehensive, and then a lot of black girls came in their first year. So there were other students of colour, a few. So there was like a girl from Hong Kong, there was a girl from India, myself. That was in my class. So when people ask me about my background, I tend to describe it as very white, which, coming from a mixed race black family, impacted on my family in lots of different ways. And certainly by the time I went to drama school, which was the Rose Bruford College of Speech and Drama, I'd had a very white upbringing, and essentially, you know, like there was sort of my sort of social circle was very white, except for my best friend Jenny, who was half Iraqi. And she's my friend who lived in Blackheath. We're still great friends. And but she didn't really identify as of colour. And she didn't look of colour. But her father was actually an Arab-looking man. He was an Arab. And we, you know, you choose these childhood friends kind of based on people who you can somehow relate to. And I think subconsciously we related to each other because we both came from mixed-race families, even though she didn't really look like she did. And my identity as a person of colour was not really very formed in terms of an awareness of being black. But that's a choice you make as well. You know, the whole sort of your identity in terms of being black, mixed race, biracial, the whole way that we categorise ourselves is something that I came to when I was in my late teens when I went to drama school. So I would say there was probably a period in my life where I wanted to be white, which I think is inevitable. If you're coming up in that kind of background, you don't see yourself reflected in the... We were not reflected as people of colour in anything around us, you know, apart from negative images in newspapers. You know, the National Front was quite lively in my area. You know, there was a sense of danger if you were of colour. And my father was incredibly strict. Because of that, he had so many kids. He had four boys, four girls, so... We, you know, he kept us off the streets because he wanted to protect us. And, of course, that then meant we weren't very worldly wise and didn't have great social lives because he was kind of like keeping us at home, close to him. And then I went to Rose Bruford College of Speech and Drama, which was amazing because I'd chosen to go to on a community theatre arts course. I had... I tried over... 3 seasons to get into various drama schools, and I always got into places, but I never got into anywhere I necessarily would have been my first choice. So in the end, I think I got into 4 drama schools. I'd never got into RADA. I tried. I never got into Central. I never got into Guildhall. I never got into Drama Centre. I never got into Bristol or Vic, which were considered the top drama schools. At the time, you think it's because you're not good enough. And, of course, later you realise, well, no, I was never going to be accepted because they accepted one person of colour every few years. But eventually I did get into somewhere that I really wanted to go, and it was called Rose Bruford, and it was a community theatre arts course where you created your own theatre, and that appealed to me because I had been part of Greenwich Young People's Theatre group from the age of 12 to 16. That's how I got into theatre. Absolutely loved it. Loved the culture of theatre. It wasn't that racially mixed, but I never felt that I stood out. It was a little bit racially mixed, but I never felt I stood out because it was the kind of environment where you were just who you were and you were accepted, and it was truly wonderful. And it really shaped me as a person. And So that's how I became somebody who was interested in theatre, and then I pursued it at school, and I got some good parts at school, and then at the age of 14 decided I wanted to be an actress. And Rose Bruford, as I said, community theatre... I know the point I was going to make was that in 1972 I saw a play by the Bubble Theatre, which is this big tent theatre, and they may still be going, and it was on Blackheath Common. And I'd gone with my friend Jenny, who was also part of the youth theatre. That's where we met. And there was an actress called... oh, my God, her name's gone. Cleo Sylvester. Cleo Sylvester was the first black actress I ever saw live. I was 12, so I was young, so that's pretty good, actually. And she was with the Bubble Theatre, and I just thought, oh, this is amazing. And she was mixed race as well. And she always stuck in my mind. I met her about 10 years ago, because my husband's an actor, and he did a show in her venue, and it was like, oh my God, Cleo, I must tell you what an important influence you were in my life. And it was a community theatre company, Bubble Theatre. It was like taking theatre to people as opposed to, you know, to different environments, as opposed to having to go to a theatre to see a show. And that perhaps sowed a seed for me that community theatre might be something that I enjoyed. You got another question?
So I think I need to adjust your mic.
Mm. It's hidden.
It's a very enthusiastic, so...
Oh, where do you want it?
Yeah.
Further down? Is it all plosive?
No, but what can we do is we'll just... because you're
moving.
Animated, yeah. So
animated.
I'll just put it like that. If you could just be conscious of it.
Okay, I won't move.
Fantastic. If you don't mind, I'll just put it down a little further.
Okay.
And then just, you can move. You can totally move. It's just what you were doing is kind of doing that and kind of.
Oh, was I hitting it? Oh my god. Okay.
We'll just continue, but also I guess behavior on the question. So.
Okay. You just press a button and I go.
We can also just cut it out. So it's really interesting what you're saying because, you know, the next question I have is when was your coming of rage?
Which oh, coming of rage. I love that expression. Isn't it good? I bet other people have stolen it. Coming of rage. Drama school. You know, when I went to drama school, I loved it. I loved drama school. And it was absolutely the right place for me because it was not a traditional drama. The course I did was not a traditional course where you just performed in extant plays, you know, which would have probably really limited the kind of theatre I could have, the kind of roles I would have had. Because I know people in other drama schools, when they're of colour, you know, it might have changed now, but I don't think so. There's a terrific actress called Michaela Cole. Do you know her? Oh my God, she's amazing. Well, she went to Guildhall, and when she went there, she was the first black woman who'd been accepted in 5 years. Now, my cousin Victoria went there, and there were three black women there when she went there in the early 90s. And I could not believe that they'd gone back, and that in 5 years, that, you know. Anyway, so that's what it was like when I was growing up, you know. And if you were a black actor in a drama school, the chances are you were not going to get cast well at all. Because the whole idea of integrated casting, multicultural casting, casting cross-racial, colourblind casting, that whole concept hadn't really taken off when I was at drama school. So I was so lucky. Well, lucky. I made such a good choice to go to a place where, A, they did do colour... I got to play Lady Macbeth, which was great. They did do colourblind casting, but also we created our own theatre. But the main thing about Rose Bruford was that there were five black women in my year, which was probably the first time that had ever happened in the history of British drama schools, I would think. And it probably could only happen at Rose Bruford because it was a political course and it was a community theatre arts course. And so they wanted people who were going to create their own theatre companies and create their own theatre and so on. And those people were Patricia St-Hilaire, who kind of worked, we formed Theatre Black Women together. She left theatre by the end of the 80s, she kind of left it. But she did write some libretto for a couple of African... She wrote one for the Royal Opera House, and I think she wrote something for Egido. But she didn't really continue as a writer or somebody working in theatre. The other person was Paulette Randall, who is basically our leading black women theatre director, and she's amazing. As a theatre director, well, in many ways she's amazing, so is Patricia, but Paulette stayed in theatre. And has just carved out an amazing career for herself. So there were three of us. And there was also someone called Joan Williams, who was a very talented actress who went on to work in the West End in musicals. She then became a social worker after a few years. And somebody called Barbara Lee King Minardo, who we never kept in touch with, and she didn't really, I don't think she went into theatre. But there were five of us. So you have this... mixture of a community theatre arts course, you know, you've got a feminist movement and women being empowered in that way, and we would get feminist and very powerful women directors, one black woman director coming, actually two black women directors at Rose Bruford's. You had the five of us, so we were strong together, we gravitated towards each other and created our own theatre. So what was the question?
That's a great answer to that question.
Okay, good.
I guess my next question would be, that was kind of the genesis, like you say, the kind of seeds were being sown from your very early experience, and then it was kind of cultivated at drama school.
Well, we cultivated, they did cultivate it, but they also tried to nip it in the bud. So the other experience at Rose Bruford was that we formed this company, well, we didn't form a company initially, we did a play called Coping, which was about five different kinds of black women. So that was the show we did together in our second year. And Yvonne Brewster directed it, who, of course, became one of our leading theatre director before she gave it up, and now it's Paulette Randall. And she came and directed us. And so that was a great sort of you know, recipe for something that would be powerful and black woman and focused and free, and that we would be able to express ourselves and so on. And what the nature of the course was that when you devised your own shows, you would go into the community to do some events, you know, to do some performances rather. So I think we did a performance at Brixton Black Women's Centre, a couple of other places. And suddenly, there was this huge demand for this work that we were doing. We were like, wow, this is amazing, because nobody else had done it before. And then the college said, nope, you can't go out there, you've got to continue with your training. That's what drama schools are like, right? You don't understand it when you're in the school, because you think this is a great opportunity, but they can be very controlling, I mean, unless they've changed, of how much work you can do outside of your course. Because the idea is that you're still developing and so on. So they nipped it in the bud, and there was quite a lot of conflict around that, because we felt this was an opportunity to get this show out there, because it just absolutely hit a button and kind of, it captured the zeitgeist for black British women. But no, they wouldn't let us do any more than, I think, 3 performances.
So what was when you were kind of establishing the theatre, you did get funding from the GLC.
Yeah.
Do you remember what that was, or how you kind of went about that?
You should talk to my friend Patricia, because Patricia, she was really the sort of manager of the company at the beginning, and she's got a very good memory, Patricia, and she'll remember a lot of the details that I don't remember. So what happened was we left drama school, we formed Theatre of Black Women. Paulette stayed with us for a year, then she got a directing apprenticeship or whatever at the Royal Court. So she left, so it was Patricia and I running it. We got £500 from the Minority Arts Advisory Service that used to exist, which at that time was a lot more money than it is now, obviously. And we got some money from a charity. It's actually a Jewish charity. No, we did get Gulbenkian funding, but not initially. We got it. It's Daniel Cohen charity or something. It was only a small amount, and we got GLC funding. And we got Hackney Council funding, and that was probably our sort of start-up costs. The GLC funded us perhaps for a couple of years or so, and then of course they went, because Maggie Thatcher, of course, got rid of the GLC because they were funding groups like ours. It's just so shocking. But there was a woman who was working in the theatre department of the GLC, which of course at that time was run by Ken Livingstone, who's a great supporter of all kinds of radical groups and movements and so on. And she was called Parminder Veer, and she was the officer who we dealt with, and I'm sure she was in theatre. She was married to someone called Julian Henriquez, who's a filmmaker. I think he's Trinidadian. But she was incredibly supportive of us, and you know, we heard about the funding, we went for funding, and we got funding. And you would go, the funding would come, you'd put in your application, they'd help you do your application, because we were new to all of this, and then it would go through to a committee, a funding committee, who passed it. I can't remember if they passed it the first time or not, but eventually it was passed, and they funded us, maybe twice. And it was always project funding. We also got funded by, eventually, the Arts Council, but also by Greater London Arts, who were also, you know, the sort of Greater London Arts was the main funding body for organisations such as ours working in London.
And to have a body like the GLC operating in London, what was that like at the time?
Well, it was amazing. I mean, I don't remember all the details of everything that went on, but it was a very fertile... Well, you know, this is a rhetorical question, right? You know, it was a really fertile environment for, you know, people in the arts who were not represented in the so-called mainstream, you know. So anybody who felt like they were an outsider, and that would be working class, disabled people, all the people that the Daily Mail and probably the Sun and probably other newspapers vilified, and vilified because the GLC funded them. So it would be, you know, gay, as we'd called it then. And people of colour, left-wing organisations, so the environment was such that you could be funded. And often I think the GLC funding was kind of initial funding as opposed to, I don't know if they core funded. I don't know, maybe they did. I mean, we were always getting small funds. We got small funds. I don't know if other people got bigger funds. Maybe they did, but it meant that all of the arts was given a period where it came of age, is that the expression? Yeah, I suppose it came of age in the capital because there was funding for it. So all these oppositional, marginalised demographics were able to express themselves through all of the arts. So that would be, to spell it out, theatre, publishing. I mean, there was sort of Sheba Publishers, which was really very pro-black publishers. I was involved in Black Woman Talk with their poetry, their first poetry anthology. I was one of the editors for that, or one of the group for that. There were dance groups, loads of theatre companies. Other black women's theatre companies came through, visual arts, of course. There's an exhibition in Nottingham, which I think has just opened, looking at some of the artists, the black women artists, I think they're black women, from the 80s. I mean, I think it's only black women from the 80s. And that's like Lubaina Himid and Sonia Boyce, and I remember them going to see their Thin Black Line at the ICA, which the ICA has always been a prestigious arts venue. Although it was more kind of cutting edge. Well, actually, I can't say it was cutting edge. It was a little bit more shambolic then, you know. Now it's a very glossy, probably extremely mainstream kind of venue. But it wasn't then. It was kind of a bit of a... It was still sort of had its legacy of its hippie origins. I remember going there in my sort of mid-teens to the ICA, and it was really kind of like a scruffy, alternative, hippie place, and sitting there and just feeling so cool, you know, with my friend Lucy, because like, wow, look at us, we're in this arty environment. And of course now you pay to get into the building, but that's how it was. So yeah, so it meant that... I'm not saying that all of this arts activity was of a high quality, right? But they were early days. There was serious funding for these groups, and I think a lot there were. Of course, it wasn't the beginning in a sense. Like, it's a bit kind of I can't think of the word. But there were things happening in the 50s and 60s. I can only talk about the 70s and 80s. Really, the 80s, but I think that the level of funding that was available for the arts in the 80s. Was what made the difference. And the venues were funded as well. So the women's groups were funded. Nothing to do with the arts. They'd be funded. The, you know, all the kind of alternative community centres would be funded. So that meant that you would have a show. Financially, you would have a show. You'd have to charge for the show, however much you charged. You'd be funded, subsidised, but you'd need to bring in income from a tour. And the venues would be there who had the money that they also got from, say, the GLC or wherever else to pay for that. So the economy worked to a certain extent, but it was heavily reliant on subsidy.
And what do you think about that? So now, I mean, to put it another way, how do you compare the kind of theatre landscape when the GLC existed to when it disappeared or when it was abolished?
Yeah, well, I mean, I'm not up to date with kind of alternative theatre now. I'm very pleased to see that the Oval House is, I think it's celebrating its 40th anniversary? Yeah, it's 40th anniversary, because the Oval House, that kind of venue, was just, every show we did, we talked to the Oval House. There was a fantastic director there called Kate Crutchley, who always, she was just wonderful, you know, and we always had these venues who would always take our shows, and that was always great. And then we'd try and get venues elsewhere, and it was always a struggle. What happened in the 90s was that by the early 90s, a lot of these theatre companies lost funding. I remember at one stage, because I was like coordinator of the Black Theatre Forum for a period in the 90s, maybe a year or 2 years, I was like, it was a part-time job. And I remember doing a count of the number. There's a conference I put on, Future Histories, which was all about, at the South Bank, which is all about black British theatre. And it gathered everybody together to look at where we'd been, where we were going, and where we were and where we were going. And I think there were, I mean, you might know Saul Sayer elsewhere, but possibly 40-something black and Asian theatre companies. And that's just black and Asian theatre companies in existence in the 80s, in the early 90s, all over the country, right? It's amazing. By the mid to the end of the 90s, I would say that probably 90% of them had gone. That's not to say that they could have all sustained themselves. It's not to say they were all producing excellent work. But they all had their own their own briefs, their own kind of communities that they were reaching, and there was a place for everybody. But it wasn't sustainable without funding. I mean, of course, if it's outside of London, then it's not GLC funding. But there was a period in the 80s where there was a lot of funding coming from the local arts bodies, whether you were in the north of England or in London or wherever, and that includes the Arts Council, but also local councils. Like you said, Hackney Council supported us, you know, and their arts budgets were just slashed, you know, and probably hardly exist now. But you know, in the 80s, you know, all these councils would have their arts officers. They'd have big budgets, well, varying, but sometimes they'd have big budgets and they could really support the arts. So without, I would say in London, without GLC funding, it would have been, you know, like the National, you know, the RSC. Where were they then? They weren't at the Barbican, they were somewhere else. So it would have been the National, the RSC, the West End, maybe a few other sort of prominent, you know, the Royal Court, which I was involved in very briefly. I had a show put on there, but it wasn't like a full show, it was like part of a youth project.
Can you describe that show? Because I think it was Tiger Teeth.
It was indeed.
Can you talk about that?
It was a, have you got the script there? It was a choreo poem. I was very influenced by Ntozake Shange. So it was a choreo poem, and Patricia Paulette and I were asked as part of their, actually I think it was their Black Writers Festival. I did two things, they did three things, I think. So I did something as part of their youth performance, can't remember what that was, and then I did something called Tiger Teeth, Clench Not to Bite. Oh, no, I did something called Moving Through. So I did do two things. Moving Through, Tiger Teeth, Clench Not to Bite. One was for their youth festival, whatever it was, and the other one was for the Black Writers Festival, which got a bit of attention. And my piece, Moving Through, and Tiger Teeth, Clench Not to Bite, were choreo poems. And they were performed, from what I remember, by a group of young actors, youth actors. And they were monologues, and they were delivered almost as like a sort of a chorus effect. And I don't think it was that long, maybe 10 minutes or something. Paulette and Patricia did more traditional plays, which were then developed, and they had their plays on as part of something, festival at the Royal Court, and they were full plays. And this would have been about 83 or so.
And did you aspire to that kind of mainstream success on stage?
It's interesting because one of the characters in my new novel is somebody coming out of the 80s who's got a show on at the National. I've just loved writing her because it's like she's a dyke. She slept with everybody. She's just great. I can't wait to give her to the world, you know. Did I aspire to have, or did we aspire to have, mainstream success? That's an interesting question. Because we formed as a rebellion against the mainstream. We were going to do our own thing on our own terms. And we did. I'm not saying that, you know, I think our shows were rough around the edges, right? They were. But that's fine. It was, you know, we were new, we were young, we were sort of discovering our sort of theatrical voice, if you like. and our acting ability was developing. So we didn't... I don't think we did. I don't think we did. I'm just remembering. We would have really appreciated mainstream approval, but we were not looking to work in the mainstream. And I'll tell you how I know this, because we didn't go for auditions anywhere else. I once auditioned for Peter Brook, and that, you know, he's amazing, and he certainly was in the 80s, still in his heyday. And he worked with an international cast of actors and did incredibly experimental, groundbreaking shows. I saw his show, The Eek, in 1975 at the Roundhouse when I was 15, and never forgot it. It was just incredible. So he was somebody who was like a bit of a theatre guru, and I auditioned for him because he was holding open auditions, and I didn't see him, of course. He had, you know, other people auditioning. Didn't get anywhere. But that was the only audition I ever went for. So while I was acting in Theatre Black Women, I didn't go for anything else, but I was offered... I did a show with Gay Sweatshop and called Raising the Wreck by Sue Fruman. Do you know Sue Fruman? She's out and about still. And that was because they came to me, basically, because I was probably the only black lesbian actor around at the time. But yeah, so yeah, not wanting to work in the mainstream, because the mainstream really didn't represent us, and we really wanted to be a voice in the world. But if we'd have had their approval, honestly, asking me now with hindsight, I think we would have really, really valued it. And in fact, Richard Eyre, you know Richard Eyre, he's on the council. He's sitting there, and I'm thinking, oh my God, Richard Eyre, you were the mainstream all those years ago. You know, you were the boys' club, man. Part of the old boys' club that we would have railed against. Although Peter Hall was the director of the National at the time. But they were so removed from us and what we were doing. I mean, I don't think they would have spat on us. Do you know what I mean? It was like, it was very different. It was very different then. Winsome Pinnock, do you know Winsome Pinnock? She had a play on at the National. I remember it wasn't a main stage, as in the Olivier. It was in one of the smaller stages. So she kind of, you know, that was groundbreaking. I'm pretty sure that was groundbreaking, her show. But generally speaking, there was such a divide between the mainstream theatre and the alternative fringe theatre. And of course, the mainstream theatre got all the money. Still does, I guess. Yeah.
So, one of the things you talk about is, like most ephemeral arts companies, whose presence today remains only as anecdotal, archival, and historical. So, can you kind of describe the kind of trajectory of the Theatre of Black Women, how you guys went about archiving it, if you did? And
yeah, it's not really archived very well. I've got the sort of archive as such, and I'm kind of loath to let go of anything, because when I do, I don't get it back. So Unfinished Histories, I sent them a poster. I sent them something, and they were supposed to send it back, and they didn't. So we began producing 3 one-woman shows, and our first gig, I think it was the first one, was at the Melkweg. I don't know if it's still going in Amsterdam, which was this very alternative venue. And it was a women's theatre festival. And it was just amazing. It was women's theatre from all over the world. And I remember there was an African-American women's troupe called Flamboyant Ladies. Have you heard of them? And in fact, one of them, Alexis DeVoe, is still quite a noted writer in America. She's an academic. And they were older than us. There were these funky African-American women. I'd never met African-American women. And it was just like, oh my God. And their show was fantastic. And they were a black women's theatre company. And we hung out with them a bit. And it was just wonderful. And it was this women's theatre festival. And it was just wonderful. In this wonderful alternative venue in Amsterdam. And we did our shows. We got great audiences. We just loved it. I just loved it. Patricia and I especially just loved it. And came back to London. I think we toured those one-woman shows a bit, but then we developed our first script, which was Silhouettes, which Patricia and I co-wrote together. And that was the first production. We got I think we got Greater London Arts funding for that, and that toured for about 6 months. That's not every day, but that's a tour that lasts for 6 months. Just venues all over the place, you know, libraries, toilets, community centres, women's conferences, you know.
Actually, one of the things I did notice that you went to the Festival of Migrant Workers in Frankfurt and sort of went around ILIA venues.
ILIA venues, yeah, ILIA, oh my God, ILIA, County Hall. Oh, that's GLC was at County Hall, and ILIA, that's right, Inner London Education Authority, yeah. So I've forgotten that that was called the Festival of Migrant Workers, and that was in Frankfurt, and that was our second show, I think, Payaka, that Patricia and I took there. So the first show was Silhouette. Was it Payaka?
No, Silhouette.
Oh, it was Silhouette. So Patricia and I did two shows, two women shows together, before we brought in other writers. And yeah, I remember Frankfurt, because I wasn't very well travelled then. I'd like been to Amsterdam a few times, and France, and that was it. So then we were being paid to go to Frankfurt. And I remember Frankfurt, I haven't been for a long time, but Germany, a lot of Germany then was just incredibly spotless and clean. Not Berlin, but like outside of the capital. And I remember Frankfurt was like, you could eat off the streets. And I remember one day, this is not relevant anyway. I remember one day there was a demonstration through the town, and we said, what are they demonstrating about? And then we were told it was pollution. I remember thinking, but this is just like, you come and live in London. This is so pure and clean and everything. Festival of Migrant Workers. Don't remember much about it, but I remember going to Frankfurt, and yeah, it was good. And we went to Amsterdam. But was that with Payaka? We did a festival in Amsterdam.
Sure.
Can't remember what it was. I've probably got it at home. Not the Meltweg, it was another festival. Can't remember what that was. But yeah, so we were just on the road, and we got funds, and you know, pretty sure that the GLC helped to fund Silhouette, and we went on tour. You know, we'd have to hire a van, and we had a stage manager, and we had musicians for Silhouette. No, we didn't have musicians for Silhouette. Did we have musicians for Silhouette? I can't remember. And the play was written as two monologues, kind of, that we then sort of spliced together to create this. It was always experimental. It was almost performance art. It was definitely not kitchen sink drama, as we used to call it. It was always trying to find the best way to express the stories that we wanted to tell through the form that worked best for it, which of course is what I still do as a writer of books. But that's what we were doing with the stage. So we would always have symbolic sets. There'd be quite a lot of movement. It was very heavily influenced, as I said, by Ntozake Shange's For Colour Girls Who Consider Suicide and the Rainbow Is Enough, which we saw in London about 1980 or not 79. And the experience would be an unconventional theatrical experience.
What influence do you think Theatre of Black Women had?
Well, other groups came up. So there was Munira, and we kind of mentored them for a bit. They were great. Munira Theatre Company, M-U-N-I-R-A-H. They did a few shows. I think they probably came up a couple of years after us, and they were quite a physical theatre company. I can't really remember their shows. One of the company members, Adziko Simba, now lives in Jamaica. No, tell a lie, she lives in Trinidad. And she's a writer. She writes children's books. And I actually bumped into her when I went to the Bocas Festival a few years ago. I hadn't seen her since the 80s. So there was Munira. There was a company called Options, which Carol Russell and Jan Blake ran. Do you remember them? Do you know them? Jan Blake's a storyteller. Carol Russell, I'm not sure what she does, but she's out there on social media. She seems to do some kind of development work, getting people of colour working, writing scripts or something. So they were also a theatre company. there was a company called the BB Crew, who they played like Shaw Theatre. So there was the there was a black male company. Oh, what were they called? And they had quite a few black male leading actors in it. And it was a kind of like a comedy troupe. They'd do skits. And then there was their equivalent called the BB Crew, with these black women actresses who were doing quite well with their careers. You know, all of them in their sort of 20s probably. And they would do skits. And because some of them had quite a high profile and had done telly and so on, they got quite a lot of attention because they were comedy and skits. They had quite a wide appeal. You can find out about them online, but I have seen stuff about them online where they describe themselves as Britain's first black women's theatre company. And I'm just like, I think I emailed, I don't know if I ever got a reply. I was like, no. You came many years after us, you cheeky bastards. But let them, you know,
so
be it on their conscience.
I mean, I think that's something you've spoken about before, actually, history and the kind of importance of it, and how it's not always, I feel like we've had conversations about how there is this kind of like much more hidden black history that isn't often acknowledged.
Well, all of it is hidden, pretty much,
still. I mean, what do you think about that? Why do you think that is? Why do you think that's perpetuated?
Oh, history generally. You know, we have a big problem in this country, and with race, we really do, and we don't acknowledge it, and we always look to America, American literature, American films. You know, of course, there's been amazing films coming out of America recently, absolutely amazing. But I think for us as black people, and also for the wider society in Britain, often that's enough, and it's not enough because they're not telling our stories. You know, they're doing Roots again, right? Which I've seen twice. I saw it first time it came out. I saw it when I was writing Blonde Roots, and I don't think I could go through it again watching it because I'm just like, oh no, I don't want to go there emotionally because it's just so harrowing. It's brilliant, but it's harrowing. And I'm like, yeah, you're doing Roots again, but why not another British story? You know, British history, as we know, goes back to the Romans. My book, The Emperor's Babe, was the only one writing about a black girl in Roman Britain. Nobody else has done anything like that since, I don't think. There has been a black presence throughout the last 2,000 years, as we know. And there are so many stories out there. You know, there's evidence of characters who've lived. We know, you know, more about some of them than others, and we still haven't mined it as a creative resource for the arts in this country. Not even the black arts, just the arts in this country. Part of the problem is that we have to accept that we are a minority. We are a minority, right? So we are Afro-Caribbean people are something like 3%. They bandy about a figure which is something like 13 or 14%. I don't know where they get that from. Asian people are probably about 6,000. But anyway, we are about 3%. And then there are people who classify themselves as mixed. But I don't know where you find how that's broken down. So if you're looking at people of the African diaspora in this country, you are looking at such a tiny minority. Yet, of course, we feel entitled. Of course we do. Because this is our country as well. But the weight of the white demographic is massive. And then amongst our number, how many of us are able to get into positions of power and make a difference in society? Very few of us. Numbers are against us generally, but then we also have to deal with all the kind of socio-cultural issues that affect our communities, plural. And we could go through and list all these issues, what they are, you know, the overrepresentation of black men in prisons, the single mother syndrome, you know, which we don't take seriously enough, as well as the sort of institutionalized, covert, subtle racism that predominates, as opposed to the in-your-face, overt racism that we can handle. And it's only when you look at statistics that you realise how bad the situation is. So, you know, I'm a black woman professor, right? I'm like the 18th black woman professor in this country out of 17,000. 17,000, right? And there are about 60 black men. Right? There are about 3,000 Asian professors, right? So that's how bad it is. 3,000. So these statistics are genuine statistics from various reports in the Times and so on, in the Times Education and so on. So when you look at that, and you look at the longer I spend in the academy, this is not about the GLC, the longer I spend in the academy, and in circles, professional circles, where I see how things happen, the more important I realise it is for us to be up there. So obviously, in the 80s, I was an outsider. Now, I get inside the institution, and I make a difference from within the institution. And that's where you need to make it. I'm not saying, you know, being outside and sort of knocking at the castle gates isn't important. It is. And doing your own thing, it is. We have to do everything, you know, everything to make a difference to how we exist in the society, but we definitely need to be inside the institution because I see how it works, and we're not. So just as an example of the number of black professors, that shows you that we're not there. And you may think, well, why only professors? Well, professors are people who are given status, they're given authority, they're given power, they're given a voice. When you hear people on the radio, experts, they're professors, right? You know, when you hear about reports being made and commissions and so on and so forth, they're professors. They're the people. Professors are the people who don't have to look over their shoulder in a way that all other academics do as they climb the greasy pole of success. You know, so, you know, you're in an institution, you have to be really careful about how you behave in order to get on ahead. Once you are a professor, I'm not saying you can just do anything you like, but you can then start setting the agenda. And this is just one field, the academy. We're not there. So this is part, it's all a big problem, and it's all buried. And to the majority of the population, it doesn't matter. It doesn't matter, because we're so inconsequential. We don't have that voice. We don't have the voice of the African-American lobby. You know, they're always complaining. I'm like, Jesus, you know, come over here. They're always saying, we're not good at this. And I, you know, you go to these conferences and there's amazing, powerful people who are all doing their thing and supporting each other. And, you know, they've got the readership to support their radical alternative writers and so on, as well as their more mainstream writers and so on and so forth. So, yeah, it's a big issue. Big issue.
Okay, so I've got like two or three more questions.
Okay.
So what was the public opinion of the GLC at the time?
Oh, well, there was the opinion of people such as myself who loved it because we were supported by it. So there was the sort of grassroots, left-wing, alternative contingency who really appreciated the GLC and the way it was changing the artistic landscape. And then there was the vicious, nasty, right-wing media who absolutely vilified, hated, ridiculed it. So they would make fun. It was like the worst joke you could tell against the GLC was that they would be funding a one-legged black lesbian group. That would be how awful it was. That was like, for them, the sort of nasty right-wing media, that would be the epitome of disgust that they had for the kinds of people who were being supported by the GLC. And their campaigns were awful. And the Standard was like that as well, had a different owner then, and I'm sure some of the other papers, there was a big campaign against the GLC. And then Thatcher, of course, got rid of it. because in a way she was getting rid of the artistic opposition, you know. So, and we're there now with Trump, aren't we? So,
what was the artistic opposition?
How did just that we would be the people I've mentioned, the people in the arts working at the grassroots level, forming their own theatre companies, arts groups, so on and so forth, were very politically engaged. You're very politically engaged, and not Tory, anti-Tory. Not that everything we did would be political in the sense of political with a capital P and railing against Margaret Thatcher, but we would be in a front. Some people, there were many political theatre companies, left-wing political theatre companies, who would be kind of, you know, dealing with Thatcher as sort of their object of hate. But just by our very existence, being empowered, being radical, being alternative, not buying into whatever Tory ridiculous beliefs about the nuclear family and, you know, good old Victorian values, which was bandied about in the 80s. You know, yeah, really, really want to go back to the Victorian era, really? So we were an affront to that. And we were scapegoated and a target.
And were you involved in campaigning against the abolition?
I don't remember. When was it abolished, do you know?
1986.
I don't remember. I don't think we were funded by it by then. Was there a big campaign against it?
Yeah, there was a huge campaign. And there was also a final night celebrations on South Bank, which happened on March 31st, 1986.
I don't remember. Don't remember that.
But do you remember the aftermath?
No, what do you mean?
So once it was gone, do you remember...
Well, no, because we were then funded by the Arts Council. Well, we lost our Arts Council funding eventually, a couple of years later, but we weren't funded by the GLC, so there was no direct... Actually, there would have been a direct effect. You know, you need to talk to Patricia, because she's got a better memory on these things. There would have been a direct impact in terms of venues, having the funds to hire us, you know, for sure. There was a venue called Yara Santua. Have you heard of it? It had originally been called The Factory, and it was in Paddington, near the Harrow Road, and it was actually a black arts centre, and they always booked our shows. It was fantastic. It was small, you know, and they did community activities and stuff. And so they began as The Factory, and then they became Yara Santua, and... I think they might even still be there now, but I don't think they're a black venue. But I'm pretty sure they lost their funding. Don't know, they got money from somewhere else, maybe. Harrow Council or something.
And what do you think the legacy of the GLC has been?
Well, I think that history, you know, and don't forget that a lot of... The companies, there were loads of women's theatre companies as well, loads. A lot of those artists, they didn't disappear. You know, they kind of cut their teeth working at grassroots level and then moved on to do what they're doing now if they stayed in the arts. You know, Anna Furs, do you know Anna Furs? You know, she taught me at Rose Bruford. She had a company called Split... No, it wasn't Split Breeches. It was... Yeah, Split Breeches was Peggy. Oh, they were so funny. Peggy and Lois. Yeah, they were great. I mean, they were American, but I remember seeing them as cracked up.
Was it Fire in the Pocket?
Can't remember. It was the mid-80s, you know, when they were just quite new, I think. Peggy in particular. Anna Furs had a theatre company. Can't remember what it was called. You know, now she's sort of at Goldsmiths, professor, director of something there, you know. So a lot of people are out there, seemingly as part of the establishment, but I think I just saw that she's going to start up a course on satire, you know. So part of the establishment, but not really, still producing kind of interesting, radical, alternative work. But then the arts world has changed to encompass that. So the theatre the theatre that had been so traditional became much more inclusive. You know, it did change. It became more inclusive, more experimental. The alternative, what would have been alternative in the 80s, is now possibly mainstream in the 10s, you know.